Hey, good job. Yeah, it's
Hey,
good.
that was fun.
Yeah. You got time?
Yeah.
You need a second? Yeah. Let's,
Yeah. You gonna bleep out my salty language?
I don't know. I might.
You might have to. We're just put a warning up front. Greg cusses.
I might. We'll just have to see.
Hello, this is Todd Littleton with Pathological, a podcast for the pastor theologian. A podcast that explores the intersection of life, faith, and thinking theologically. You may have happened onto this podcast via my Substack newsletter, Can We Talk? And that really is the whole point. When thinking through the intersection of life, faith, and thinking theologically, it happens in conversation with friends, with neighbors, with new acquaintances, and with longtime invested folks. So that's what we're doing. We are inviting a longtime friend to have a second conversation. That is, my friend Greg Horton and I spent the prior episode talking about DEI and indoctrination, particularly as it related to public education politics in Oklahoma. So we're venturing a bit outside the boundaries that are normally set for a theological or a pastor theologian podcast, but these things are important. And so we are trying to strain very eagerly to talk about policy, politics and policy. Sure, we, by frame of reference, our friendship goes all the way back to times where we spent talking about religion and faith more frequently. But now we're looking at these current issues in Oklahoma politics. And deconstruction has been another buzzword. I thought the buzzword was gone 20 years ago. But here it becomes now a bogeyman. This is another fear-mongering term. And the realities are, aside from the deep philosophical roots that have given rise to some of the skepticism about certain philosophical figures, we deconstruct almost every day. And so hopefully we can say that what we're working toward is a better understanding of what we're saying when we say what we say. Because communication is key in a democracy. It's a key in asserting helpful policies related to public education in Oklahoma. And as a reminder, Greg teaches at a couple of our higher education institutions here in the Oklahoma City metro area. Again, we've been longtime friends, and we've hashed this subject over for the last 20, 25 years together. So we're doing it again. And as always, I want to thank you for listening. And, share the pod. Hey, folks, welcome back. This is episode 2 of my conversation with Greg Horton, longtime friend. I was adding it up when we kind of got back together for episode 1 that we've been friends nearly 25 years, and it's been a good one. We value one another, and even to this day, we don't get to see one another as much as we did. Greg's got like 50 jobs, and I'm busy, and that's just kind of the way it goes. But we will be catching up for mutual breakfast lunch soon, and that will be just part of what we do every summer. So when we left you, we were kind of giving a little hint that we were going to talk about deconstruction, because that is now, again, believe it or not, all these years later, Greg, a reified buzzword. It's come back. I thought it was done. I thought everybody was through with that. And then here we go. And so, folks, we're going to talk about that. If you want to know a little bit more about Greg, go back and listen to episode 1 if you haven't already. And you can hear a little bit about Greg. And along the way, I'm sure some more things about our friendship will kind of come out to light. And so, Greg, here we are. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
So here we are. When we were looking at the issues of DEI and indoctrination and what groups do that, once we find out that we have maybe been indoctrinated in a way that we've discovered there's some things about it that I just, they no longer resonate, or you really discover that those aren't true. For example, and this is a risky illustration, but the late Robert Weber, longtime evangelical, very influential in helping some folks 20 some odd years ago kind of capture a little bit more of the great tradition, not the small t tradition, but the great tradition of the church and the liturgy. And he was kind of in vogue in about 20 years ago. He since died, but just before he did, he wrote a little book called On the Canterbury Trail. And in his book, he stated things this way: we are given what we believe. And that could be about anything, folks. So I'm broadening it. We are given what we believe. We are born into a family. We are born into a context. We're born into a particular time frame. We are given what we believe. And we just take that lock, stock, and barrel. Our parents indoctrinate us. Our culture indoctrinates us. We're indoctrinated. Then we hit adolescence or somewhere else down the road, maybe later than that, and we begin to question what we've been given. Maybe we discover that in 1921, it wasn't a race riot, it was a massacre. And now we have to go back and adjust. Ah, wait a minute. I was told that this is what went on, and I was told this is why there's such divisions. And then he finally said that once we've worked through whatever doubts, whatever questions, we come to our place where here's what we believe about the world. Here's what we, in his case, here's kind of how I believe about faith. So if we do that, what someone would say is that in that intervening, that middle part was Weber's deconstruction. He questioned what he had been handed. So Greg, that's pretty rudimentary for someone who, like yourself, has taught philosophy, has addressed that, but right. take it from there and let's kind of work it a little bit.
Again, we said this in part one, there are words that in and of themselves are not terrifying, but they are plucked from their context and relocated elsewhere. And then they are either used for good or for ill. I'm sure Derrida is not getting any royalties on the use of his ideas. It was Derrida and Foucault, for those of you who aren't philosophy people. Continental philosophy post-World War II, and even a little bit before World War II, was reckoning with the sort of fall of the West that Nietzsche so well details in Thus Spoke Zarathustra and a couple of his other Beyond Good and Evil. And I know Nietzsche's kind of scary too, but the truth is he sort of saw what was coming. And Derrida and Foucault pick up on some of that cynicism. And it was cynicism, let's admit it. I almost said a naughty word. We had 6 million dead Jews, 13 million dead total, 100 million dead from the war in general. We had atomic weapons. We had a Holocaust. I mean, come on. Some cynicism was warranted. And so deconstruction for those two guys really was, especially Derrida, was evaluating language not just as a thing that carries meaning, but a thing that carries power, right? And so, and you grew up in the church, I grew up in the church. And we've both seen the ways in which language is used. You're dealing with it right now in the SBC. We talked earlier about trying to get no women pastors ever as part of the handbook, or was it not the
Constitution?
Constitution. And so Derrida would say, well, let's see then, if you would say no women pastors ever, let's look at the power matrix here and see who benefits and who is hurt, who gains, who loses. And so deconstruction at its core is really a recognition that, think about white America in the 1950s and colored fountains and segregated schools and segregated everything. And so then the Bible itself is slaves obey your masters, all that kind of language that comes from there can be directed for that purpose, in the sense that it's no longer just trying to convey meaning or faith. It's now trying to convey control. It's trying to say, this is why you have less, this is why you are less. And so Derrida is looking at those sort of statements, those sort of, messages, and saying, let's look at these a little more closely and see what's at stake here. And that's really, in a nutshell, what it is. I mean, if I was doing an intro to philosophy class, that's exactly how I'd explain it. Because, yes, there are much more technical and much more complex uses of the thing. But in the context of what we're talking about now, precisely what's happening. Now, we started with DEI, and part of what I teach students to do is to deconstruct virtually everything that they deal with. And it's what I call important, right? Don't worry about what clothes you're wearing, what color they are. We'll get to where that came from, and, you know, children making iPhones later on. But for now, let's just talk about the important stuff: faith, politics, family, you know, those kind of things. And then how many things were you taught growing up that you never critically evaluated? You just, your parents don't lie to you. That's our assumption when we're 4, 5, 6 years old. So how many of those things did you receive non-critically? Now let's go back and look at all of the things you received non-critically, and let's evaluate them in light of your experience with the world, what you've learned, where you are, that kind of stuff. It's kind of the opposite of indoctrination, in the sense that it's asking you to look at those doctrinal elements of your life and then be sort of critical, in the best sense of the word, critical of their truth value. So that's kind of where we are. That'll work. There we go.
Yeah. No. And so I think that when today, so kind of trying to shift and help our listeners grasp it, that really is a very good popular way, I think you say it that way, popular way to understand deconstruction without having to wade into some of the sort of weightier technical sides of that. I think that maybe it would merit kind of easing the anxiety over what are some things that naturally we might question once we have developed our critical skills. So rather than immediately jumping into a particular educational issue or even religious issue, but what are some things, you're a parent, you've been around college students. Yep. What are some common things that really are fairly rudimentary that we all probably come to at least some point? And once we develop some critical skills of thinking, I see that different now.
Yeah.
And so is there something common, or are there a few commonalities that you'd recall?
The two big ones for me are advertising and I love you.
Okay. Let's hear it.
Those are the two biggies. Advertising. You remember when you were a kid and you saw that thing that you just had to have on Saturday morning? It was for the viewers that are old. We used to watch cartoons on Saturday mornings before the wonders of technology delivered all the damn time. So we get up on Saturday mornings, we get our bowl of cereal, we would sit in the living room floor, and in between commercials, the evil advertising people, because it was evil, let's admit it, created these wildly colorful, amazing sort of commercials where, oh my God, Mom, I have to have this thing. It works perfectly. And then Mom finally is just weary and she says, okay, fine, we'll get one. You get it and you open it and it's garbage. Like, it doesn't do anything that did on television. It's just awful. And you remember that bitter disappointment that you feel, and you're not old enough yet to go, they lied to me. You just think that, you know, this one is not what I thought it was going to be. So that moment when you're old enough, now I still struggle with people who watch food commercials and don't realize, because, you know, I write about food so much. They look at like, man, that'll be the best food ever. Yeah, that's because they use oil on the burger to make it look shiny, and they do this, and those aren't real French fries. And oh my God, what do you know? You learn to look at advertising and see what they're trying. They're trying to separate you from your money. Do you really need this thing? You know, consumerism and that sort of deconstructive advertising should have gone hand in hand, but one got ahead of the other. The other one is I love you. I mean, and I tell kids this all the time. It's like, does your mother love you? Of course my mother loves me. Well, how do you know she loves you? She does all these things for me. I mean, so did your mom grow up in this kind of family where everybody was a good parent and they tried to be? Of course. So then your mother really wouldn't want to be a bad parent, would she? Well, no. So she could hate you with every breath that she takes and still do the right thing and not love you at all. And so that is to say, to help them understand that so much of what we evaluate in other people can only be internally verified if we got inside their brain and clunked around inside there, right? So when someone says, I love you, it's not wrong to say, why are they telling me that? Do they really love me? Your mother? Yes. I'm just being cruel to the children and I enjoy that part. But for the most part, our mothers do love us. But what about the boy that's trying to separate you from your pants, or the girl who's trying to separate you from your, you know, your attempt to not have sex, or whatever it is, right? We have villains on both sides of the aisle. The truth is, we think about these things, or we should think about them all the time. When you go to buy a house, I hope you deconstruct the mortgage documents. I hope you look at them closely. That's what it is. You're seeing what they're saying to you and you're asking what it actually means. Vague language is the enemy of clear thinking. And this is a drum I beat in class all the time. Beware of people who use sort of vague definitions. They cannot be trusted whatsoever. And that's where we are in Oklahoma with vague definitions right now.
Yeah. And I mean, I couldn't help but think, and hopefully this won't force us down a rabbit hole that it may be for a whole nother podcast, but you know, I was thinking about the young Duggar who was in the recent Shiny Happy People, who discovered after she was of legal age that a contract had been signed with her for with TLC.
Yeah.
And so you're sitting here and you were just thinking, what are all the ways that my life could be deconstructed? I've now found out that someone actually signed something for me that is not the best for me.
Right.
And really what we're saying is not necessarily that everything is so pessimistic in that. Sure. Someone's always out to get me, but it does mean that I now start thinking more accurately about what I've got my hands on so that I can actually say, ah, yes, this is true, or right. No, it's not true. And is that a fair?
No, because it recognizes that some of the worst things are done with the best intentions.
Right.
Now, in the case of the Duggars, he was clearly just an evil bastard.
Oh,
but,
my.
But the reality on the other side is people do things for you or want to do things for you all the time, but they have the best intent in the world, and it may be the worst thing for you.
Absolutely.
So there's nothing – I say that. I'm not trying to create cynics. I'm trying to create people who know how to think. Right. You don't doubt everyone. Don't be that dude. Like nothing's going to go right. He's a liar. But be the person that's like, hey, can I take a minute and read this? Or can I ask you a couple of questions? And it doesn't have to be hostile. It doesn't have to be antagonistic. It can simply be you making sure that what's being offered is something you understand is true and is good for you.
That's exactly right. So when we start talking, and this was kind of the trigger in that Facebook post was, What are some things to deconstruct when we are dealing with a state school superintendent who is using these loaded words?
Yeah.
Who is substituting substance with letters?
Yep.
Who is clearly, at least it seems, trying to thwart the one value per dollar. And then reduce the number of dollars required to provide a good education for public school students.
So remember, was it 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, they did the bonus and all these teachers signed up and the money came from a federal grant. Remember that? Mm-hmm. And then Walters gets on Twitter and he's like, this is what happens when you use free market solutions. And in my class, I said, okay, let's pause and evaluate this. Is a government grant to fund a project or a program a free market solution, or is that a government subsidy? Well, it's clear what it is. Clear. It's not a free market solution. And you've heard me say it, I'm okay with accountability. So yeah, the government funding projects is awesome to me if it's for a good cause. And so that's one of those moments where Walters is just saying something that's like a dog whistle. It's a buzzword. Free market solution means all the libertarians are like drooling now. They're so excited, right? But there are other more pernicious uses of those things too, in terms of the word indoctrination, the way he uses it. He's telling parents to be afraid of what these liberal teachers are telling their children. So you got to stop and say, okay, what is scary about diversity? What is scary about inclusion? Is it complicated? Yes, the logistics of inclusivity is complicated, rightly so, because we're complicated people and races and cultures have their own sort of practices and beliefs. And I like to tell people, imagine being a white guy sitting in a theater watching a comedy made by Black filmmakers for a Black audience and trying not understanding why they think it's funny and you don't. Right. Because our experience, what's the old idea? You live in a world of a very specific set of experiences. And if you haven't experienced that, then you can't know what they're dealing with and what those things mean. And so deconstruction allows us to ask the questions, why don't I understand? How is their experience different? How could I even participate in it? I write about food, right? One of the ways you can participate is you can go to a restaurant that you don't understand. And rather than do the white person thing, like, where's the free chips and salsa? You can actually just eat what they put in front of you, right? And then try to understand their culture. So that's for me what it is. And Walters refuses to use the more, you know, let's go to Chesterton. He refuses to use the more generous orthodoxy of the definitions of those words. And he insists on the more restrictive, narrow-minded, scary, I'm going to make you afraid of everything kind of definitions. So it's like you said, it's been reified. Yes, it has been reified, but it's also been redefined to some extent. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. that is a longer sort of explanation than I intended, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, and I think there are a couple things in there. I'm trying to write the other one down. One of the things that came to mind as you were kind of giving that description of how we're setting up the us versus them by the loaded language, right, is to say in Oklahoma, for instance, we probably should deconstruct the statement, all of those liberal teachers.
Yes.
Because what we've discovered in Pastors for Oklahoma Kids is outside of Tulsa County, Oklahoma County, and mostly down around Lawton, if you go to any rural school district, the majority of the teachers, admin, coaches, who are involved in those, are often have a relationship with one of the churches in town.
100%.
They are civically minded. They take in those children who don't have that we're talking about. Yeah. They're not looking for equality, but equity. Let's see if I can't give out of my own paycheck to help this child improve. We castigate superintendents who are also bus drivers and lawn care professionals in these small districts. But now we've taken the reddest state in the country, the reddest state by county in the United States, and we've said all those liberal teachers. Now, if we don't deconstruct that language, then every argument from there, which should be regarded as specious, becomes now a platform for, okay, here's this piece of legislation that this representative from rural district Oklahoma found on the ALEC website that says, here's what your state needs.
Yeah.
Because they are not imaginative enough to come up with what does my community really need. I need to go find out from the Millhouse what they're producing that they need to do so we can prove we're still the reddest state in the country.
Which leads to the next stage of deconstruction, which says, what are they really after?
Exactly. Right?
Because it's clearly not about education at that point. And so this is why I think a deconstructive framework is good, because when you see someone like a Walters, we could name another former president, a couple other people, who are using words in a way that demeans the meaning of the words intentionally, so that he creates this sort of cloud of confusion and fear. And so at that level, you say, what does Walters really want? Does he really want better education for our students? No, clearly he does not. If he did, he would engage in meaningful conversations with the people on the ground, the superintendents who drive the bus, the teachers who take care of the children every day, the ladies in the lunchroom who literally have to look at poor kids who can't afford food and explain to them why we're going to change policies related to free meals and that sort of stuff. That would be a sign that things are right. The fact that he's not engaging in those conversations means there's something else at stake here. So deconstruction in that sense is the best way to approach a complex problem. It becomes problematic when it's applied to things like faith, because we feel like, well, it's my kid, I should be able to teach them whatever I want. And we're not going to argue parental rights today. It's not interesting to me necessarily, but we will say that I think public school isn't the place to inculcate those sorts of teachings. The old joke, I teach world mythology too. And one of the old jokes was, oh, you want to have creation and evolution in the classroom? Cool. Let's go with, let's the Cherokee one with the water bug. Or how about Boomba the Creator, the North African one with the god vomits the world into existence? Or how about Marduk and Tiamat? That would be super cool too. Let's go with Babylon. So when you start talking about that, then you ask the question, what do you mean by creation narrative? Do you mean the Bible? Do you mean yours? Or do you mean sort of wider array of those things? And so I think deconstruction is problematic for those people because it tries to reveal an agenda that they don't want to, they don't want to say the quiet part out loud. That's really what it is.
Right. And I think that one of the things that, to borrow a word from our friend Tripp, problematizes this scenario is that when you raise the specter that what we're seeing is the result of the denigration of public education, where the lack of critical thinking shows up in a large, I'm going to have to say this carefully, in a large segment of a given population sector that are identified as in support of all the loaded language politicians you can ever come up with. And what you find out and what nobody wants to say, the thing that nobody wants to say out loud is that the distinctive mark in most instances, according to researchers who explore these things better than I could ever,
right,
that some of it is a lack of education.
Yeah.
So we're actually producing, they're actually producing the thing that they want. And what happens? They're separating them from their money with loaded language to work a power angle where they have the advantage over, well, those who they've convinced loaded language is the way the world works.
Yeah.
Is that too cynical?
Well, see, and that's the thing, right? Is we, and that's the accusation. If you start talking like that, then, well, you're a cynic or whatever. But and the truth is, and I try to tell students as well, like, don't build the explanation so large that it makes everyone a liar and you a cynic, right? There are places you can draw the line. Like, we know Walters is a con man. That's what he is. He's probably a closeted gay man. The photos don't lie about that. You and I sat at dinner many times. I never put my hand on your thigh and leaned up against you. It's like, that's just not something that we do, right? And so so you can look at those factors too. And you can look at the fact that he is in bed with some wealthy Oklahomans who have a vested interest in private education, which we know is not going to work well. It's just not going to. But at the same time, I don't need them to have from the very, I don't believe everybody that's on his side wants the destruction of public education. They want the reform of public education along a Christian line. Which would be, listen, if I was in a majority Muslim country or a majority Buddhist country, we'd be having the same conversation about a different demographic of people, right? That is who people are ultimately. And you know, and we've had this discussion before years ago, it's been frustrating me for a long time. We have this whole arm of the church called Christian education, and it is not. It is clearly indoctrination. Again, not necessarily anything wrong with that. We talked about that before. But the fact is that if you are going to indoctrinate without education, you are going to end up with people who don't know how to think critically about the world. And I said this to you years ago, if you ultimately are going to educate Christians, like children and young adults, if you're actually going to educate, it always comes with the risk that they'll say, not for me. But that is the one thing we don't want to have happen in conversion communities.
Right.
And so we want our kids to follow in. And honestly, here's me not being a cynic again. Those parents really think that's what's best for their kids. They're not being assholes.
Absolutely.
They genuinely, if they believe in hell, they don't want their child to go there.
That's exactly
100%
right.
Understand that, yeah, right? Yeah. And there's a level of deconstruction that we talk about that too, but that's not what we're doing here, right? Mm-hmm. That's a religious conversation. This is more politics and policy.
Yes.
And so I want my kids in schools where they are taught well. And then I want them in churches, synagogues, temples, mosques, where they're also taught well. Mm-hmm. And that has not been the case very much.
Right. And I think that those then become, if we're going to talk about a value of deconstruction, then it requires some critical thinking about, okay, so why hasn't that been? What would it take for that to be the case? What sort of illustrations, even maybe remote, that they might be, what would they be that would help someone with that particular vision where we're taught well in both arenas and we can accept the realities that whatever in our best intentions are for our children, raising them up in the particular faith of which is our own, and maybe hoping that they actually find that the same value we do, and then they don't, will we still apply that same ethic of love?
Right. I think about the old story about rabbis. I don't even know if it's true. I do know they discourage conversion, right? Which is, for a Baptist, that's going to be the weirdest. Like, did you fail your evangelism class? What is happening here? They discourage conversion because the goal in Judaism is not to get converts. It's tikkun olam, right? It's to heal the world. Mm-hmm. It's to unbreak what we break all of the time. Yeah. And if your goal is to unbreak things, then if you're a Jew or a Muslim or a Christian or an atheist, we're all on the same team as long as what we're trying to do is heal the world. Yeah. So there is no ultimacy in Judaism in the sense that, oh my God, if you get this wrong, you're definitely going to hell. So the ideology, and it's true of Islam as well, the ideology shapes us to think about the world. This is all Wittgenstein, right? The language that you're given as a child, you talked about Robert Weber earlier, the language you're given as a child affects the way that you're able to view the world that you live in. It literally builds the world. Mm-hmm. And so if I grew up Jewish and I'm thinking that there's no such thing as hell and we're just trying to make things better, or I grew up Christian, it's like, oh my God, this person's saved or they're going to go to hell, then those become the ways that we deal with people. Mm-hmm. Deconstruction looks at that and says, wait a second, what if, you know, parable-wise, what if we just all worked on the same building and that building is justice and it's kindness and it's goodness? And then if you believe in heaven and hell, awesome. And if you don't, awesome. But do you believe in a just world? And can we build that together? And somehow that's not even present in the conversation right now. It's all, you know, scapegoating and demonization and othering and all the things that happen that I just lost scapegoat boy's name.
Gerard.
Yeah, thank you, Gerard. I was talking about.
Yeah, and I want to be, you know, I want to be clear, not to maintain my evangelical cred, right, but to say that certainly I think a good understanding of the God of justice at work in the world would produce people who would bear witness to what that looks like in whatever relationship they're involved in, whatever, I don't know that I like the word sphere, but whatever part of life that we're engaged in and involved in. And I think that the idea that the world has never been pluralistic is a weird turn, because I think it always has been, and it's always been demanded. And the difference here and the distinction here is that for some, the world is never going to be a just place if it isn't ruled by a particular form of the Christian faith. And I would go on record and say that I don't think that's the way it works out. I don't know that is, in other words, I don't think a theocracy is going to solve the problems that it is purporting to solve. And I'm not even, well, I'm convinced that's not even what we find in the narrative arc of the scripture. So yeah. I think that having a conversation here where we've tried to maintain a focus on politics and policy, though dipping into the religious, is important, because this impulse is everywhere. So it in terms of a religious impulse, it doesn't have to be just Christian.
Right.
Everyone who opts for a particular religious practice or affiliation, or I don't know what language you use with classes, but whatever that is, we still need to learn that in the world where we live with others, we have a particular responsibility to those others.
Yes.
not to dominate them, but to see if in a world we can't create a just context, because then I think that's the only context in which we can really bear witness to any kind of faithfulness that we believe Jesus demonstrated. So
I remember being in prison. That's another story from the time, you already know it well, and reading Schlossberg and some of those guys that were the original dominionists, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking about theocracy as this distant sort of, I'm not going to worry about it, Christian people really understand. And, you know, Islam has had its moments too, where they tried to create their own sort of, the sort of ultimate understandings of the world. But for me, I guess the genuine surprise with Trump and post-Trump has been the theocrats are godless. They're godless as hell. It's been when I thought about theocracy as a thing, I kept thinking, well, there'll be a religious impulse that will sort of mute some of that. Well, what happens if the godless decide they want a theocracy? And everybody's worried about atheists. You need to worry about, well, let's talk about Paul here. You need to worry about wolves in sheep's clothing. That's what you need to be worrying about right now. Because the theocrats don't know God. They're godless. And that has been the most problematic from my framework is like, oh shit, this could really work because they don't really care. Mm-hmm. All they really want is power. Mm-hmm. So we're back to Nietzsche again, right? If the ethic, if I can use one ethic to get the thing that I actually want, I'll give it all the lip service in the world. And that's what's happening.
And to take a particular interpretation of that parable of the madman, in essence, we have killed God.
Yeah.
And he died.
Yeah.
And that is, well, that takes us a whole.
Well, no, but it's Nietzsche. What festivals, what atonement, what will we do now in the absence of that vacuum? Nature abhors a vacuum. So in the absence of that sort of, well, no, they never lived it out. Some of them did try, but it never, Christendom was never a success in the larger, if the goal is Christianity, Christendom was never a success, but at least it was an ethical target, something to shoot at, right? I've been mystified, and you know this, over the last 25 years, as I've taught, Christians don't give a shit about the Sermon on the Mount. The literal heart of the ethical heart of Jesus' teachings, they have no use for it whatsoever. It drove Tolstoy to madness. He was so obsessed with it. Yeah. Christians today, oh, that's just so we know we need God. No, that's not, that literally doesn't say that anywhere in that passage. Not a single word about that. So that is problematic to me because, again, the godless are running the God business. Mm-hmm. And if you're a Christian, you should be very, very concerned about that. It feels like a double gut punch, I know, for evangelicals lately with the Hillsong's documentary and the Duggar documentary. Well, damn it, it's well deserved because some of y'all weren't paying attention and you've let the fox in the hen house, so to speak. And it's the women and children that suffer as a result of that.
And I think I'll try this one out. I think a young friend had used this phrase. I think that, and I think there's some well-meaning people, frankly, who do this, but I think it's because we don't want to do the work of interrogating the language. And what happens is you pose those issues, and then what happens is they spiritually bypass you. Mm-hmm. So this phrase spiritual bypassing, I think is a new one for me in a way of kind of framing that, well, you know, we still have this.
Yeah.
Or you should really think about it this way. It's really spiritual gaslighting is what it is. But,
yes,
but
it is.
The language is spiritual. For this person with spiritual, you're bypassing the very issue that we're talking about. And I've had my own instances where you raise the specter of interrogating the language in hopes of getting right at something's more true and beautiful. And immediately you're written off.
Jim Bob Duggar was a perfect example. Yeah. With that statement he released as a result of the documentary.
Yes, you probably
saw the post about
I
that.
Did. Yep.
It was a perfect example of the use of deconstruction. When he says in there, we have long believed that, you know, you settle things privately. I'm like, no, that's what an abuser does.
Right.
He isolates you from your support network, and then he gets to do whatever and say whatever he wants, and he makes you feel shame, and he makes you feel afraid, and he and so to use the language of scripture, to abuse someone, it doesn't get more grotesque. Does not.
No.
And so if you aren't thinking critically about the world, and it happens all the time in religious circles, it's like, well, I mean, it is in the Bible. And do you remember in the Hillsong documentary, it was the Matthew 18 thing. We're going to go, was that Hillsong or was that Duggar?
Yes.
It was Matthew. It was still Hillsong, right?
Yes, it was.
It was Brian Houston.
Yes, it was.
To protect a pedophile. Yeah. He's like, well, it's all about Matthew 18 now. You got to go to your brother, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, no, all that does is further the abuse. The Southern Baptists are right now, as you well know, struggling with this new appointment. I've been reading online. Doesn't look great in terms of what that means for victims and women in the ministry. And so we have to learn. I love that. Interrogate the language. You have to do that because they're not all using that language in the best way with the best intent. No. A lot of it. And I hate it because there are good people. People in ministry, people who try to do the right thing.
Yeah, they really are.
They get lumped in. I am weary past telling of every time something happens with Duggar, some dickhead from the New York Times is going, well, evangelicals, he's not an evangelical.
No.
He's not even a stone's throw from the line. That dude is such a fundamentalist. It's so if we're going to have a gross misunderstanding, and even the, do you remember the part in the Hillsongs where the woman says out loud, "I didn't know that there was a Hillsong Australia." You're a journalist. What are you talking about?
But you and I have had this conversation over the last, 6-8 years, that the definitions are so malleable to whatever point the writer wants to make.
Yep.
So that the language really has not meant anything. That's why I think I use interrogate the language, simply because deconstruction frightens people. So no, let's interrogate the language because when a label is attached, you and I have had this discussion. When a label is attached, is it self-identification? Am I identifying you? And depending on how that works, who gets away with it, and does it mean anything?
Right.
So
I sincerely hope that everybody that watched the Duggar documentary, I hope Christians looked at Jim Bob Duggar. Is that his name, Jim Bob? That's so awful. No. Jim Bob Duggar, and said, that man is not a Christian. No. I hope they have the critical ability to see that what that man is like, if you looked at what's that guy's name from the Fundamentalist Latter-day Saints, the Mormons didn't have any problem whatsoever saying that dude is not us. And we are happy that he's in prison. Jim Duggar should be in prison and Christians should be happy about it. Because at some level, that is the culture itself at large helping you clean your own damn house. And that house needs cleaning. Mm. Now, it's true that the left does too. We have some issues over there.
Right.
Be clear that we're not talking about that today. Nope, but if you wanted to, I'd happily delve into identity politics and all those things. But yeah.
Absolutely right.
Okay.
Absolutely so. Right. Yep. Well, good. So folks, Greg and I'll get together. We've got another, let's see, it's the middle of June. Greg's schedule will amp up again in August. So we'll try to come up with a few other subjects along politics and policy. Here in Oklahoma, and try to give another offering, as it were.
We might have something interesting to discuss after this week in Southern Baptist circles.
I want to be optimistic, but sadly, I'm a realist. So
we're recording this the day before the convention starts, I believe.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Well, Greg, thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it.
No problem. I love it.
Yep.
See you soon.
All right, man.